now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome to The Ruck, your penultimate episode of the rugby podcast for the Times Sunday Times of this regular season, although we will be going on tour to Australia. Joining me today, Mark Evans, regular attendee of this podcast, and Alan Dimmock, features editor of Rugby World magazine. We've got an enormous amount to talk about this week. Two seismic Gallagher Premiership semi-finals. The first URC final will be all South African. Today, Monday, the RFU will launch the fixtures for the new community game season, branding it as the biggest overhaul of grassroots rugby structure in 30 years. And John Inverdale, the RFU council member and chairman of National League Rugby, will join us to discuss that. But first, we have to reflect on the sad news that we all heard yesterday, Sunday evening, and the passing of Phil Bennett. Mark, you grew up in Wales. You tweeted about it this morning. There are no words really to describe what he gave to this game.
No. People talk about legends, and Brendan Gallagher or someone said, more of an immortal, and I think that's right. Yeah. I think he's in the line of, you know, Cliff Morgan, Di Watkins, Barry John, Phil Bennett, Jonathan Davis, the sort of the golden line through Welsh number 10s. And he's up there with them, some would say, at the very top. I mean, that's just a personal view. But the other thing I'd say is that, you know, they say don't meet your heroes, don't they? Because you're always going to be disappointed. Well, he was the exception to that. He was just the loveliest of men. And, just such a lovely person.
That's the thing that I keep. I probably count myself as being a bit too young to know too much. I mean, legends is probably what I know about Phil Bennett. But you look through all that's been written about him, even before now, and the outpouring of emotion about it. And the thing that keeps coming through that you keep seeing people talk about is just what a nice bloke he was. And it's, you know, if you take the rugby out, then that's all you could want.
Yeah, and we can be a bit, you know, being rugby or whatever, and players rugby is a great bloke, which is nonsense, isn't it? But he was, you know, so rooted in his community of Ellenboyle and West Walian through and through. You know, in some ways, didn't like touring that much preferred to be at home. But is if you never saw him play live, just an extraordinary player. The sort of stardust in his feet, you know, up there with, you know, the others you remember, you know, Jason Robinson, you know, that there's the sorts of players who don't come along that often because it's really hard to do what they could do, and he'd be terribly, terribly missed.
We've talked on this pod with you, Mark, in recent weeks about the state of Welsh rugby and its decline when. And I count myself with Al, too young really to understand the impact that he had on society and life in Wales at a time where rugby was so kind of tightly woven into the fabric of life. Just give us an idea of that, like the inspiration that he would have been to generations of young players.
Well, he followed Barry John, who was an equally but incredibly different type of fly half. Phil Bennett was much more electric, Barry glided and Phil just jinked, I suppose is the best way to put it across. And the game was different. And there were, you could play a little bit more like that. And my word, he did. And the we've got, you know, the videos and the films do him justice. I mean, you know, the Lions stuff against South Africa on very hard grounds when he had a wonderful tour. And then he was captain in 77. It wasn't nearly as happy a time. And it probably shouldn't have been given the job, to be quite. But he was such a good player that it was almost inevitable. But... yeah, he epitomised a lot of what it was in a golden era for the Welsh team, but more of a golden era for the sport in Wales as much as the team. He epitomised it, very rooted, as you say, in his community, where he was from. They just don't come along that often.
No. Well, sad news to break at the end of a weekend in which was actually... on the field for everyone, pulsating in so many different ways, which we'll get into now, starting up with the Gallagher Premiership semi-finals coming up next. So we've been going since September, and we now have the Gallagher Premiership final, Saracens against Leicester. Saracens, but I guess both comeback stories of different types. Saracens beat Harlequins 34-17, Leicester down Northampton 27-14, two enormous games. Let's start at the Stoneck Stadium, Saracens. I was there on Saturday. Mark, did you see any result from that game other than a Saracens win at any point?
Yeah, I didn't before the game. I thought Saracens would win quite comfortably. And you could look at the score line and think, well, that's what happened. I don't think that quite tells the story of the game. I thought the game's momentum shifted, and if some buts and maybes, you know. But when Lauday got held up with 8 minutes to go, which would have taken them to very, you know, you could see it thinking, well, if he goes over now, that's going to be really interesting. But he didn't. Wonderful defensive play. How did he not score? And Saracens saw it out and then scored another one at the end, but the game was gone by then, to be honest.
I just loved that game. I was sitting there thinking there's a lot of stoppages here, but the word that you use a lot is flow.
Yeah.
And it was a game where there were a lot of stoppages, but it didn't, for me, it didn't interrupt the flow of it. It was almost a chance for everyone to
take a breath.
Just like understand what they'd just seen and then go again. And
would you say it was more like a boxing match in that it's like ding ding, back to your
literally
corner,
at times,
and then you come.
It was ferocious. It was ferocious. It was the intensity was off the scale and it almost got the perfect to set it up for the neutral. Got the perfect start with Harlequins making the early running. Their scrum was magnificent. Their maul.
That's a big point I want to talk because it's. For some reason, there's still quite a pervasive view that the forwards of Quinns might be marshmallow compared to a couple of other teams. And it's just absolute nonsense because their scrum, I mean, Will Collier, the way that he went.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
geez, wow.
And, you know, there's a reason why there's an awful lot of buzz about them. And just the way that pack operated, it was just what the game needed. And then when you've got that, and then you can go, right, we can break off the back of a scrum that's going forward. And, of course, as we'll talk about, if you've got an Esterhuizen in your back pocket and if you've got a Kerr running off of a shoulder, it just adds a little bit of spice. But, I mean, friend of the podcast, Ross Hamilton, was tweeting out some stats after the game, and it was clear that red zone efficiency was just up.
That's
through
the point
the
I Absolutely, was going to make. Yeah. I think the big difference between the two sides, they both had them periods of dominance. This is what Alan was saying. I like that analogy. They both won a couple of rounds, didn't they? You know, for starts. I felt, and I watched it back again. I watched it again because I couldn't go. One of my closest friends' 60th birthday lunch. I couldn't. I was very mixed feelings. No, it was a lovely little CMT. He's great, but wouldn't have missed it for the world. But it was a shame. I thought it was about finishing.
Yep.
You look at the number of times. I always judge it now. If you go into the 22 with the ball in your hand, or you get the ball in your hand in the 22, now, how many times do you score? And if you do that, you go through it. And I would say this is the thing that links the two games, and we'll talk about the other one in a minute, I'm sure. Saracens were just far more efficient in terms of when they got a chance. I think they went in there 8 times and they scored 6. Something like that. In a 5 tries. And oh, yeah, oh, that's right. He missed a drop goal? Or he got, no, missed a drop goal. So, incredibly efficient. Harlequins, on the other hand, went in there 12 times and came away with 3. And I haven't seen Ross's stats. I don't know if I might have missed a couple. I wasn't doing it rigorously. But the thing about Saracens was that they are so good at taking the chances. They don't actually create... And I'd say that's been Harlequin's weakness all year, by the way. I think the number of chances that they create, I think it might even be subconscious. They're so... And I love this about them. They're so wedded to this jouer, we're going to play, we're going to create things. They almost, I think, subconsciously, well, all right, we've just binned that one, but all right, we'll create another one in a minute. And at the very, very highest level, if I'm sure the Queen's coaches here will be going back, right, guys, we need to graft a couple of things onto what we're doing. And one of the things is, in all games, you've got to take a higher percentage of the chances. I think Saracens will win the final. I know we're going to come talk about that again. I think they'll win. However, their scrum is undoubtedly a potential Achilles heel, because they got... I thought they were lucky, actually, with one or two of the calls. I really did. I thought Quinn's scrum had them on toast.
I'd like to talk about the yellow cards in a minute, but there were so many... We asked Mark McCall afterwards about the key moments, but and there were...
Loads.
There were loads of them, and if you take... Jack Walker flying into Owen Farrell, clash of heads, Walker's off 10 minutes. In those 10 minutes, Saracen scored 14 points.
Yeah.
The second of those two tries was a mistake from Alex Donbrand from the kickoff, but ruthless. Took the chance, scored it. That turned the game, put Saracens on top. For the last 25 minutes of that game, Saracens only had a full complement for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Mm. And... So when they had their chance against 14, they scored twice. When Harlequins had the chance against 13 and 14,
they took one and got held up once, and that, I think, was the if they got that one, but they should have got more.
Correct, but it's also like it was Nick Izyekwi who held
it was,
up Lord
it
A,
was.
The same player who stole two
line-outs,
critical lineouts,
absolutely critical.
You know, 5 meter lineout, you're not supposed to. I mean, in fact, I saw it in the Super Rugby semi final earlier in the day. Conventional wisdom is you're not going to challenge because you've got to set for them all. Izyekwi springs up at the front.
And again, linking the two games, I'd say the difference between... Leicester made very, very few errors, and neither did Saracens. Whereas Northampton and Harlequins, you've mentioned one of them, Alex Donbrandt screwed up a restart, led to a try.
Yeah.
You know, that... The lineouts that you've mentioned, there were errors in Quincy's game, and I was trying to find any real important areas of the pitch that that Saracens made. You couldn't find any, and also for 20 minutes, but it was only for 20 minutes. Again, love Alan's that in that round or a couple of rounds, they won every collision.
Mm.
They won absolutely. It wasn't at the beginning and it wasn't at the end, but for 20 minutes. Every time there was a collision, Saracens won it, and fair play to them. That won them the game.
Now, Leicester are a very different team to Harlequins in the style that they play. It'll be interesting if you go to take the learnings from this game, whether Saracens are going to be wanting to cough up so many cards for high shots. Can you get away with that in a final against, you'd say, based on the form of this season, a stronger team? And just an interesting point on that, and I'm just going to put that out in there, and we don't have to discuss it, but it seems fascinating to me that we can be so strict on high shots and be firm on that and not waver, yet not with HIAs. I just find that interesting that they wouldn't go, if that merits a card, why someone wouldn't then automatically go for an HIA, or a few of them be looked at a bit more. It just seems a bit more like light the cigarette. Let's see.
I think the cards thing is, so I was sitting there we've all watched. I was in Marco C 3 years ago, pre Japan World Cup, where they came out with the high tackle framework. Referees were just there was all judgment was removed.
Mm.
It's a set of facts, and you come to a decision.
It's the framework.
Every one of those incidents from the Saracens game would have been a red card at the World Cup. They would have been because they were the contact was high and it was head to head or shoulder to head. Under the framework as it was, they'd have been red cards. Since then, there's been a tweak to it to allow referees to be a bit more sympathetic to the dynamics of the game.
And yeah, it's the M word, isn't it? Mitigation.
And so every one of those was a yellow on the basis of force, the perception that there wasn't enormous force. Now, the player, Owen Farrell, afterwards had no complaints with any of the yellows, including Jack Walker's. He's like, and nor did either of the coaches. But there's a tension that exists now between World Rugby trying to use sanctions to persuade players to go lower and players
and
saying...
players just being willing to wear the sanctions.
Players go, we cannot do anything other than what we're doing because you have to go... Owen Farrell's words, you have to be going forward in defence.
You got to. Otherwise you lose the position.
If you're passive, you go backwards, you get dropped. And he basically said, we'll be as careful as we can, but we have to do what we're doing, and if it's a yellow, it's a yellow. So the sanctions aren't persuading anyone to change because the players themselves say, well, we can't change.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see how that transpires in a final.
Yeah, and there'll be no sightings, by the way, either. So no. The sighting officer has studied all those incidents, including the ones in Leicester, and concluded that none of them were worthy of a red card. So I think one of the things that's confusing is we all got used to this has to be a red, and Charlie Yules gets a red playing for England in the Six Nations. But yesterday, Saturday, that would probably be the yellow, the Charlie Yules incident. So it's a tricky one. But and there were clips flying around social media accusing players of throwing punches, and none of those have been picked up.
Honestly, I you were there and I wasn't, and I saw it, but maybe people say, it was really, really feisty. I just thought it was really, really physical.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was particularly bad-tempered. Or I know there were yellow cards, but they were, you know, that's the situation we're in at the minute, and you can't defend passively. You know, if you go through, if Quinn's had gone through 40 minutes of losing every collision, they'd have been wiped out. You know, I just don't think... I like the build-up, by the way. I like the whole... I think rugby needs more of that. I like the fact that players are on record saying, we really don't... Whether they do or they don't, I don't care.
Yeah.
Come on.
Sell it.
Don't be mealy-mouthed about it and say, no one's died. They've just given it... It's a bit of an edge. And the game wasn't... We don't have that sort of game anymore. No one got... I didn't see anyway. Nobody got punched. No one got stamped on the floor. Nobody got their head kicked in. It doesn't happen anymore. All right? For God's sake, stop being so bloody prissy about it.
There were outbreaks of pushing and shoving, but what that build up and what that rivalry brought was
excitement
and an intensity. The physical, the breakdown, battle, the combat on the floor.
It's a good game.
Was unbelievable. You know, the counter rucking, the power, the physical, brilliant. It was brilliant, and I loved it. And the first thing Mark McCall said to us afterwards was something like, that was the longest game of the season, and it hadn't even felt like it. You know, there are games with stoppages, as we've discussed, as you've said, Mark, that lack all flow. Didn't feel like that at all. Yeah. It was magnificent, and I would expect a similar final. You know, it would be two teams going hammer and tongs. It might not be a thing of beauty. I think Al Russ's stat was that Leicester kicked 75%.
Yeah, it was weird to say that. 75%. I mean,
that was a different type of game. We're going on to that now, aren't
we? Yeah.
It's a different type of game, wasn't it?
I mean, they haven't shied away from who they are. They have an identity, and there's something likeable about them going, this is exactly who we are. I mean, and obviously within that framework, people can do exceptional stuff. I mean, full house for George Ford. Try, penalties, drop goal, everybody.
Yeah, show and go try.
Yeah. I mean, and I now struggle where we are with the narrative. Is 83 cap England international George, 84 cap England international George Ford underrated, or where are we now? I find it really hard to keep up with the debate on that one. But just exceptional stuff. And on the other side, I mean, it was just good fun, because on the other side we were having little crossfield dinks from Dan Bigger to Courtnell Scosson, who left his hands at home. Poor fella, three butchered opportunities off from him. He must be sick as a parrot.
And I think that's the difference between the two games. Northampton Saints will be sitting there all summer going, how on earth did we lose that? They're 15 points. Look, they're 15 points up, and I don't mean the two things that he butchered, because they then scored one straight away. You can't double count, right? But they left one try, 7 points, absolutely on the table.
Yeah.
They missed a drop goal. Dan Biggin missed a relatively simple drop goal, and they butchered a 5-yard line out. Now there's 15 points just sitting there, and it's 30 minutes in, and you're winning. They don't lose from there, because Leicester, massive strengths, and this is why I think they're going to lose the final, by the way. I can't see them scoring enough points. I don't know how they're going to score. They do hang in, though. You remember they beat Saracens at Welford Road right back in God knows what. Was it week one or week two? Something incredibly early. They were the second best team for 80 minutes, basically. And then they hung in, they stayed in the fight, and they got it at the end. If they're going to win on Saturday, I'd honestly think that's the only way they're going to win, except if they really go for Saracen's scrum. If Genge and Montoya, I know I pronounced that wrong, I'm sorry, I apologise, I don't know what they're... And Cole really, really go for what to me looks like a Saracen's front row that isn't what it was, and then the way Leicester play on the back of that might just give him a chance, but I'd say 4 out of 5 times Saris win this.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So it wasn't just in England where we had some rip-roaring semi-finals this weekend. The URC has reached its climax. There will be 2 South African teams in the final after the Bulls squeaked past Leinster 27-26 in Dublin and the Stormers beat Ulster 17-15. So we all head to Cape Town, do we, next weekend? We don't, because we go to Twickenham. But the final heads to Cape Town. Al, it was a two real cracking games, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I was just saying off mic that it's been an incredible weekend for knockout rugby. All different corners you look, really. The Premiership was fantastic. There's been a load of good stuff happening in France. And this one, I mean, I don't know who you'd have found that would have predicted that Leinster would lose at the RDS. And another friend of the podcast, Marcel Kutsia, who's been on with us briefly before in an episode gone by, putting a real captain's knock for the Bulls. They just sort of absorbed what Leinster wanted to do. They, right at the start of the game, just really tough stuff, holding them out. You know, Leinster were hammering away. They're at home, and you'd have assumed that they would score. And this is the Bulls that are coming after a 6-day turnaround. Mm. And they just absorbed it, and they kept going at it. And it was a real 80-minute blood and thunder performance. They played the way that you'd expect the Bulls of Pretoria to play. There was some direct running. Elrich Lowe did some nice carrying off the back of lineouts to set up Marcel Kutsia for his score. And it was just kind of, you can't really say shell shock, because it was an 80-minute display. It was really close all the way in. Just fantastic stuff, particularly for the neutral. But it's fascinating to see that Leinster are going to be trophyless at the end of the season for the first time since 2017.
Do you think, Al, that I think the English rugby fans will probably engage a bit more with the South African provinces next season when their club is drawn against them in the Champions Cup or the Challenge Cup. What interest will there be in a All South African final in Scotland or Ireland, do you think?
Well, it's an interesting talking point because certainly this season we've talked an awful lot about crowd numbers, and South Africa's been very affected by COVID, and you know they've had half crowds, quarter crowds. They've been doing ticket giveaways to try and get people to rock up to Bulls games, but it's interesting when you contrast the view that I've seen from people in South Africa is one of elation. They are absolutely buzzing. I've seen a lot of people suggest, why did we not do this earlier? This is much better than Super Rugby for us. It just makes more sense. There's lots of doors opening for us, and the team have been sort of got off to a rocky start and playing really well. I'm fascinated because I imagine that we'll see the true effect next season for the other teams in the URC as well. Now, Mark can talk to you about the basket case that is Welsh rugby and how people, the grass always seems to be greener, and whatever competition they're in at the moment is the one that they hate the most, and whether they truly love it. But there's a big discussion to be had about that. So I'm not sure how enthralled the folk are in Wales with it. I'm not sure. In Ireland, it's one of shell shock, but I think because they've gone deep into the competitions and two teams, it very feasibly could have been an All-Irish final. You know, because these two games were so close. And so I'm imagining that there'll maybe be a little bit of interest, almost a curiosity about what this final looked like in a completely different venue, handing over a brand new, frankly bizarre looking trophy, if anyone's seen what it looks like, over to this. And sort of a lot of people will be planning for the future. I think there's quite a few question marks still, and I think we'll see the true nature of the impact of the South African teams joining next season when people even outside the URC will be really watchful of them. But I don't think we'll see a true reflection of how in love everyone is with the idea until next season.
Yeah, I'd agree. On top of that, we didn't see the proper structure this year because of COVID. And I think that when they have less overlaps, which is what they've got planned, because they very sensibly moved away from this everybody must play everybody else home and away, which is absolutely no need for that, guys. There's lots of competitions don't do that. I think that the guys at the URC and Martin would be quite pleased at the moment. I think they might see, well, it was getting a bit of an Irish procession. You know, the Scottish teams have got stronger. You know, if you're looking at the trend, the Scottish teams have got stronger. But the Irish were starting to get way too dominant for any kind of commercial and sporting sort of interest. So I think the argument for South Africans in the Six Nations is a completely different argument. But within the URC, I think it's probably in everybody's interests.
It's felt like a shot of life, a different name on the trophy, and I'd say you said the Scottish teams got stronger, but Glasgow were truly humbled against Leinster.
They were, I know.
And because of that, it felt like, okay, this is Leinster's to do with as they wish. And it's got to be good for the competition that Leinster can't just rock up and beat whoever they want
with their second team.
Yeah,
I mean, that'll be the other interesting thing that may or may not happen. It will depend, I think, to a degree on how strong the South African teams can be in the early part of the season, if they're still playing in the Rugby Championship and they're still playing in the November Internationals. And I don't think we'll know that. It'll be really interesting. The next year, I'm going to keep a very, very close eye on the squads Leinster send down to South Africa.
They might also have to send slightly stronger teams to Scotland to guarantee points, and It shakes up the whole balance.
It does. It shakes up the whole balance about things like home field advantage in the playoffs and all that kind of stuff.
I think my one question on it is, I was at went to the Leinster Toulouse quarterfinal, and afterwards Johnny Sexton was trying to remember what the competition was called. He was like,
"Is it top 14 or pro 14?"
He said, "Like, there's been so many incarnations of it, and
needs a bit of stability now."
Competitions, they feel important when they grow roots.
Well, people understand them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, as you say, if it can settle in, there's been, you know, the gauntlet's been laid down to Leinster and the Irish teams. The structure can settle and people get used to it. And just, you know, whether you like it or not, the sight of South African teams in in Europe, in with a Saracens or a Gloucester or whoever they end up being, you know, that'll bring it closer to home again, particularly for an English audience who largely won't have watched it because they won't have Premier Sports because they're already paying for other, you know, for BT Sport, and you know that they largely won't have seen those teams play in those games. Having them in the Champions Cup will bring the competition a bit closer to home.
And before we move on, Ulster were magnificent in defeat.
Yeah, so two fascinating finals coming up next weekend. And just before we get into the last section of the Ruck, Al chucked an interesting hypothetical into our WhatsApp chat this week. That he would quite fancy the discussion, Al.
Yeah, well, it's just I'd watched with interest what was happening in the Gulf and the start of a Rebel League. I mean, Rebel League makes it sound almost quite Star Wars, doesn't it? And it's not been received anything like that. The idea of the Rebel, Saudi-backed Rebel League in golf, we'd seen the takeover of Newcastle United, and it got me wondering, with all the hand-wringing that's gone on about it and all the questions about sports washing, if that happened in rugby, would we have the same qualms, and would players have certain qualms about joining a team that was backed by someone like the Saudi Investment Fund? I just thought it was an interesting discussion.
So we're talking about the ownership of a team or the ownership of a league or competition, the whole thing?
A team, I think.
A team. I don't know, is the answer. I think we've got some history here, haven't we? Put this into context. So there's a continuum between... People say, sport and politics keep... That's nonsense, isn't it? Sport is part of life, and all of politics is choices within certain societies and cultures. So it's a question of where you make the decision, isn't it? And at what point do you say, no, actually, that's too far? Because if you go to the... You're purer than pure and, you know, more ethical than anything. There's a whole load of rugby nations you wouldn't play. You know, you look at some of the LGBT views of regimes in the Pacific Islands, for example, right? But I don't hear anyone saying, well, we shouldn't play Tonga, for example. And I agree with them. I don't know. Of course, I think we should play them. Then you come down to who owns the tournaments and who owns the teams, and you think about their motivation, and maybe that's more in the middle. I mean, the golf thing's interesting. I'm very much on the side of the sort of McIlroys and the traditional sort of PGA stuff, and you know, please, for God's sake, I think the journalist who said to Ian Potter, well, would you go to South Africa then? Good question. Yeah. Would you? Where's your line? I'm not sure I've answered anything there, but
Did you watch the golf last night? The Canadian Open finish. Rory McIlroy wins.
I did watch a little bit. Like, yeah, normally.
It was incredible. And the first thing he said was that's 21 tour victories, which is one more than a certain somebody. That certain somebody being Greg Norman, and it's almost revived a passion for where they were. Let me throw in an illustrative hypothetical question then on this. So Anthony Joshua has fought in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
We've talked about Newcastle. We've talked about this golf. If the Lions are offered a game in Riyadh on their way to Australia, should they play it if it's lucrative? B, would they?
How?
I think I know that... Well, it depends how much money it is, but I'm imagining it would certainly be entertained, is what I would assume. Should they... I mean, for several reasons, just purely rugby logistically, it makes very little sense. But then again, we've seen the Lions go and play in Hong Kong on the way to a tour. So if there's money on the table and it makes sense to them financially, then we know that the Lions will entertain it. I don't think it makes any sense, but I think they would. I don't know. What do you reckon, Mark?
There would undoubtedly be an outcry because I think people would say, you've got other options. Why have you chosen that option? To which the only reply might be, well, there was more money in it.
And I'm which is something sure... that we're not getting, by the way, with golf and everything else, is I think people would probably respect it a little bit more if folk were honest and just said, I'm improving my earning potential massively. And obviously that paints them as greedy, but at least they're not pretending... and just hiding away from everything.
Yeah, they want to go from being rich to super rich.
Exactly.
I'm not sure there's a massive amount of support for
but
I could be wrong.
Now, to bring this back, I spoke to a few people on the phone. I spoke to quite a prominent player. I spoke to an agent about this. And the response that I got was, the one from the player was interesting. They'd spoken about it with a couple of teammates, and they didn't seem any qualms whatsoever. They were just like, elite top-end rugby players earn good money. It's still not something where you could retire to a desert island on. So if someone's offering you more money, fantastic. They were talking about the landscape where there are fewer options. Basically, there was a lot of financial incentive reasons why they said it was for it. Now, what interests me is, as mentioned earlier, they ain't going public and saying that. They're not going to come out and say that. The agent's view was very much of, if the powers that be ratify a club owning it, then as far as we're concerned, play ball. And I spoke to Premiership Rugby about this morning, and the suggestion was, I asked, is there a fit and proper person's test?
Because I was just trying to make that ask.
Is there a
fit
and proper person's test like there's meant to be in football? I mean, whether that's ever successful, you can debate that till the cows come home. And what came back was basically, if a club is willing to sell to someone like, say, the Saudi royal family, then, or their investment fund, then if the RFU approve it, then game on. And if they own another club in another country, then World Rugby will have to get involved. But there's not a huge number of hurdles from what I can see.
That's interesting. So, because I was thinking this the other day, and I wasn't sure I knew the answer, and I still don't. So I don't think there is a fit and proper person's test for the Premiership, is there? I've got a feeling there isn't, because then that raises the question of, well, would you be okay playing for a team that is financed through money laundering? For example, you know, criminality. Is that where you draw the line? Because there are piles of examples in other sports of clubs that have been owned with money that is, shall we say, dubious. Let's put it that way. Okay? Is that where you draw the line? And I'm not saying any of these questions are easy. They're not. And I keep coming back to this continuum thing. You know, there are certain things, there are probably certain regimes where you'd say, no, that I'm sorry, that's just not on. Well, so, for example, here's one. So, would we at the moment, well, it would be illegal, but, you know, a Russian oligarch buying a Premiership team whose money quite clearly came from a deal with that regime. At the moment, I think most people and most would say, no, that's beyond. But a Man City-type deal, are you okay with that? And that the answer might then be different. It might not. But all I'm saying is that these are all we as a sport should be asking is, have we got certain regulatory protection in place in the event of something like this happening? Or are we just going to make it up as we go along?
It's a fascinating hypothetical conversation at the moment. And we'll all keep close eye on any future investment in the Premiership down the line. Coming up next, we have John Inverdale joining us to discuss the biggest change in the structure of grassroots rugby in England for 30 years. Joining us now on the Ruck is John Inverdale, RFU council member and chairman of National League Rugby, to really explain to everyone why the RFU have changed the community game structure and the importance behind it. It's being flagged as the biggest change in 30 years to how the community league game is structured. John, thanks for joining us. Just talk us through, the reasons behind this and the work that's gone into doing it.
Well, Alex, you know, you've spoken about Phil Bennett already, and I mean, part of my childhood died as well when I heard the news about him. But the game was very different when Phil was playing, and the game was very different, you know, a few years after Phil stopped playing, when the leagues were set up in the very first instance. And I think what's driven the changes are just a change in player habits, a change in society, a change in relationships, a change in how families operate. And, you know, you only have to drive past a lot of rugby grounds, you know, multi-pitch rugby grounds, 3, 4, 5 pitches on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And if there's one game taking place, great. If there's two, amazing. But the rest of that land is just lying fallow. And across team sport, and rugby actually has fared better than most others, but across team sport, there's a massive drop-off in adult male participation. And we, from an RFU point of view, just couldn't just sit and watch that happen because the nature of the game is changing as a consequence. So the prime motivation behind this is to try and stem the tide in terms of players leaving the game, maybe to turn the tank around, if you like, to get more people engaged, more people involved. It's on the basis of players having to travel less distances for the most part, which means that the day does not become entirely rugby-centric, but they can do other things as well. So the motivation, pure and simple, is to try and promote the adult male game, which has been suffering at the recreational level for many, many years now.
One of the stats that really struck me was that if you rewound 20 years, the research that's been presented to us says that clubs needed 25 players to complete the season, and they now need 43 players. When you were involved at Isha and heavily engaged in the
group, I am sadly, Alex.
Okay, I'll rephrase that. But in all the years that you've been involved at Isha, how aware were you of the drop off in participation and the need for more and more players just to fulfil one team's fixtures?
Well, I'm sure if anybody's listening to this who's involved in any club, they will be conscious that maybe 30 years ago, they ran six teams, seven teams, five teams, and now they're running 3, 2, 1. You don't need to do a study of it. You can just see it. You can see that the bar is less busy. The pitches, as I mentioned earlier, are empty. I think the need for the game to be flexible and to understand that if there's only 12 people, at least you can have a game rather than actually not doing anything is really, really important, because by virtue of having replacements, if you've only got 12 or 13 players, the game will get postponed. And what we should be doing actually is saying, no, the game doesn't need to be postponed. At first team level, it's a different ball game. But once you get to second, third, fourth team level, you know, so long as we've got enough players and so long as we've got a ball and we've got a referee, then we can have a game. And I think we have to be less rigid, perhaps. And I think actually what this will do, and I think what the sport needs to do as well, is it needs to look at participation in a slightly different way. Because if you and I met perhaps even now, but certainly 10 years ago, and I said, which club are you involved with? And you'd said X. My first question would have been, how many teams do you run? And you would have said the same to me. I think the first question now needs to be different. When you meet somebody from a club, wherever it might be, the first question needs to be, how many people have you got playing at your club? And what that can mean, it can mean people playing touch, it can mean people playing sevens, it can mean people playing, you know, some kind of recreational pitch up and play rugby, and the teams they've got running as well. So that if you've got teams playing on if you've got different forms of rugby being carried out on a Tuesday evening and a Thursday evening and a Friday evening, I'm a big advocate of Friday night rugby because it frees up the weekend. It takes away the stigma, if you like, of 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. But if you've got people playing at your club and it is vibrant and dynamic and alive 4 or 5 nights a week, it doesn't actually matter if on a Saturday you used to run 4 teams but only run 2 now. Because if collectively you've got enough people playing the game in whatever shape or form it might be that would make up 5 teams in the old days, you're doing fine. So I think it's just a question now of re-quantifying what the game is and what we need to make it to shape or to conform to how people's lives are changing.
John, just talk us through exactly what the changes are. We're talking about this today because Monday afternoon the fixtures will be coming out. How does the structure now look?
Well, the phrase that is used is the pyramid has been flattened. There are fewer levels. There are more leagues at each level. One of the most obvious changes from level 7 downwards will be there'll be lots of second teams that are suddenly finding themselves playing in the National League structure. But the reason for that is a lot of second team fixtures were being cancelled because one or other side couldn't raise a team. And what happens week in, week out, is if you suddenly find that a game's called off and you don't make yourself available the next week, and then you find something else to do, and then suddenly the week after there's a second team game, but you don't want to play, so your club cries off that fixture, then it's like a spiral. It's an ever-perpetuating spiral. So to try and put a lot of clubs, I mean, clubs have had the options to do this. A lot of clubs have chosen. It's been a convoluted and a complicated way of getting to this point, and I won't get involved with the rugby politics of it. But you know, many, many clubs have put their second and lower 15s into the leagues because they feel that players will make themselves more readily available, and it guarantees those players a more formatted structure to their year, and they are guaranteed a certain number of fixtures, as opposed to playing in a merit table or a friendly, where on a Thursday night people think, you know, I think I'm not available, I won't bother to play. Whereas if they know it's a league game, from the research that we've done, we think it's more likely that they will actually say, yes, I am available and I will remain available for the match on Saturday. So there's going to be lots of leagues where there are, you know, half a dozen clubs first teams against half a dozen clubs second teams. And so I think this is, there's a danger here of always sounding like a record that's got stuck. But this is about trying to ensure that more people play, more fixtures are completed, and the game is more buoyant as a consequence of these changes.
John, thank you very much for joining us here on The Ruck. We'll let you go because we know you're at Queen's about to broadcast to the nation from the tennis. But Mark, you were listening with interest to what John said there. And just to chuck in some other details, when he talked about the flattening of the pyramid, for example, Level 4, National League 2, will now have 3 leagues instead of 2. Level 5 will have 6 leagues, up from 4. You're very supportive of this move, Mark.
I am, yes. A colleague and I, we did quite a lot of research in this area 2 or 3 years back, and a lot of the things John said really chimed in. It's social change, and you've got to adapt to your marketplace, and people aren't prepared. Doesn't matter how you feel is right or wrong. People aren't prepared to devote like they used to be and just turn up week in, week out, week in, week out. They don't stay as long in the clubhouse. You know, they don't stay on the hole till 10:30. Far more children. Minis is much more important. Women's rugby is much more important. I think these reforms, fair play to the RFU, you know, less travelling, more local games, flattening the pyramid, I know it's just the buzzword, but it is undoubtedly the right direction of travel.
Okay, gents, it's God or Goddess of the Week time. Al, you'll get hand up first. Usually, this is the point where everyone does what Mark's sort of looking at the scene and going, all right, who?
Have you done your prep?
Have you done it? Al, straight in.
Well, I just wanted to turn things a little bit Gaelic and look to France because, as I mentioned, it's been another really fascinating weekend of rugby in the top 14. I toyed with the idea of a devil of the week in honor of Mark. And
Chris, not because he's a devil.
Not because he's a devil, because he introduced the idea. And Bordeaux have gone through in the knockouts. They beat Racing. But interestingly, there were some fascinating moments in the game where through the week, Christophe Urios, who's the boss at Bordeaux, had made a point of calling out Jalibert and Wauke, and they both played absolute blinders. Wauke scored a try, was holding his hand to his ear as if the old classic wrestling, like what you're saying now. And Jalibert went off the park, and there's a clip doing the rounds of him. Well, Urios tries to shake his hands, and Jalibert looks right past him as he takes it in. So it's an interesting one. You could imagine as a motivational tool, you could suggest that it actually worked calling those players out because they played bloody well, but I don't know how sustainable that is. So I toyed with the idea of Urios, despite winning, being a devil of the week. But actually, I wanted to give a shout out to Melvin Jaminet. Now, we all know his exploits at the back for France. Is coming to an end of his time with Perpignan, where he was spotted.
Yeah.
Perpignan at the weekend became the first team ever from the top 14 to win in the playoff with the team that hadn't been promoted yet from the Pro D2. Normally, the Pro D2 team comes up and takes over. Perpignan managed to hold on. Jaminet hasn't played an awful lot for Perpignan last year. He's been away with France. He's had injuries. He's on his way out of the club. So as a sort of parting gift to them, he helped them keep their place in the division. So Melvin Jaminet is getting my God of the Week.
Good man. Very good.
Yeah, good. This is going to sound extraordinarily sycophantic, so I apologise in advance, but he's just been on. I know it's not just him, and I don't think we should underestimate how hard it is to get structural change into league structures. And I think what John Inverdale and his supporters within the RFU have been able to do this week is really excellent. It's been a long time coming. There were a lot of forces of resistance, as I understand it, and I think it will help. It's not a magic bullet, but it will help to get adult male club rugby back into the type of structure that is eminently more suitable to the modern era than one we've had, which has been creaking and straining at all kinds of levels. So you'll be terribly embarrassed, but Julian Vidal is my God of the Week.
Good suggestion. I'll go onto the field, and there's any number of options. We've talked about Nick Ezekwe, talked about George Ford, Owen Farrell. I'm going to pick Ben Earl, not just because he scored a hat-trick, but it was his all-round performance in a ferocious game was outstanding. At the end of a week in which I was on the panel who eventually concluded that he was the Premiership Player of the Year, which I must say wasn't the result I thought we'd reach on the way in to that conversation, but he delivered a performance that added some real justification to that award.
If Ben Bromfield, he'd have been mine as well.
Yeah.
It was just terrific.
Terrific, wasn't he? And there's an England squad to tour Australia coming up, and if the tradition of the Premiership Player of the Year
he won't be in it.
So you'd have to make
it
do
is
with
the curse, isn't it?
With
it
our
is
God the of curse. The Week prize instead. So here's my suggestion, my nomination. Everyone, thank you for joining us. We will be back next Monday. We'll have the Premiership final to discuss, the URC final to discuss, an England tour to look ahead to, as well as Scotland and Ireland.
The French Final Four.
And Wales. French Final Four. There's still plenty of rugby to go in this season. Mark, Al, thank you very much for joining us. This episode was produced by Alfie Reynolds.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.